welcome. This is Wendy McCarty Van Bemmel, and this is our Mind Matters podcast. We're so happy to have you with us today. Mind Matters covers just about anything in regards to mental health, advocacy, trends, what's going on in our community. I'm so excited to have two lovely guests with us today. We have Marielle from La Massage. She is our clinical director at our residential facility.
Hi, Hi everybody.
Good to see you. And we have Rhoda Richardson, who is a school psychologist with Seminole County Public Schools. Hi, Rhoda.
Hello.
How are you both doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Me too. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome, me too. So we're going to have a deep dive and talk a little bit about youth, mental health, school system, kind of a guide for parents on how to navigate mental health concerns, and then maybe get the perspective from the school system as well, since we have Rhoda with us. Mm-hmm. Rhoda, what do you see the most when you're working with kids within the school system?
Oftentimes, the biggest challenge with our students is they lack skills, whether it's social skills, whether it's social emotional skills, they just don't have the skills to cope. And therefore, they respond in a way that is, of course, unacceptable in any arena, not just the public school system, but in society as a whole. And, you know, they grow up to become those adults who continue to lack those skills. And we have all kinds of issues. So I would say the biggest issue is our kids not having the necessary skills to be successful in life, period.
That makes sense. Are you seeing a lot more of that since post-pandemic?
Absolutely. I think the pandemic just exacerbated. It's always been an issue, but we see it even more so now because the family unit as a whole within our society, there are a lot of parents without jobs. There are a lot of parents who have been evicted. They have so many more stressors now since the pandemic, and it's starting to impact our kids even more so, even though those concerns existed beforehand, if that makes sense.
What are some of the things, Rhoda, that your colleagues in the school system are coming to you about, you know, in reference to that change and what our kids are going through and how the behaviors are changing post-COVID?
Just those basic social skills. Kids just don't know how to be socially appropriate.
Right.
Especially our kindergartners coming in. I mean, we assume that they have the skills to walk into the classroom and sit crisscross applesauce and walk in line and listen and follow directions at first. That's not the case. That's not a focus for many of our parents for whatever reason. It's not a focus. And the school will teach that. I'll let them do it. And the school expects parents to teach that. And it's just not happening. A lot of our kids are very aggressive, both verbally and physically aggressive, because they don't know how to use their words to convey their thoughts and feelings about certain things. So I'm just going to act out to get my needs met. So many of our teachers are just saying our kids don't know how to behave. Help me help them. And to be honest, many of our teachers don't have the skill set to do that. They know how to teach.
Yeah,
I got the academics down, but how do I manage these behaviors? I haven't been taught that. Help me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so something's happening in the family system at home, and we can talk about that, I'm sure, for hours.
Yes.
And in the school system, it sounds like what you're saying is that teachers are doing more parenting lately.
Yeah.
Which, it's hard to say that.
Yeah, that's how they feel, because they feel like, well, the parents should be teaching these skills, not me. I'm focused on the academics. However, we've been sharing with our teachers, it's not just about reading, writing, and arithmetic, but now it's about regulation. We have to add that fourth R in there, because if we don't, we're not going to be able to teach.
Is that impacted by, I have a seven-year-old who if he could play tablet all day long, he would. Like, I have to regulate it. But I think this generation coming up is just so used to one, not talking, maybe not expressing emotions.
Yes.
And just everything's digital. It's instant gratification. It worries me as a parent. And I see that in the kids we work with at our hospitals too, is just that dopamine, dopamine, dopamine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Wendy, think about it this way. We come from dial up. We had to sit there and patiently hope we could connect to the internet.
Yes, we did. Yes. We had to talk to people on the phone. Yes.
And share the phone because it was a house, right? A house phone.
One phone, one line.
Yeah. And now, what I'm embarrassed to say this, my kids have two Apple tablets and they have the Amazon tablets. And if one battery dies, they grab the other, and they have not been exposed enough to how to tolerate things that aren't happening right away, not being perfect. And I apologize to all the teachers out there because my kids might be terrors in the classroom being patient.
But that's so true. That's a great point, Wendy. Social media. That's what I mean. You know, this year with the laws that have changed about cell phones in school, that has been a huge issue. Our kids are struggling. I cannot access my phone when I want to. They're having a difficult time with that.
Are you seeing a lot of that in, I would guess, in middle school, high school? Or
yeah, and you know what? It's in elementary now, too. A lot of our elementary, fourth, fifth grade kiddos, they have cell phones. It's not as big of an issue as it is in middle and high school, but it's an issue.
So what would you do as a parent who has a kid who wants to use their phone, wants to use their tablet all the time, maybe is showing some of those aggressive signs? They're a great kid, but just seeing all these things that we're talking about, where do you go from there?
I would start to set limits. Slowly easing into it. It's not, okay, you can't be on your phone Monday through Friday, only on the weekends. Or, oh, okay, when you're used to being on it 5 hours, now it's only 30 minutes. We can't do that. However, begin to set limits on phone usage, social media access, more closely monitor what they're accessing as well. But I would start by setting limits. But when I'm setting the limits, explain the why behind it. Kids need to know why you're doing this.
I love
that. It's really, really important to explain the why. When you get into the work world, you have to have social skills in order to communicate with your colleagues, customers. You're not going to know how to do that. I mean, that's just an example, but the why is important.
And with some of the families that I work with, clinically, why means that as the parent and the authority figure, you have a right or you deserve for me to explain this. And that's a bad thing because it takes the power away from that boundary, that consequence, right?
So they think.
Yeah. And I could see a lot of parents struggling with that, but you know, you're onto something, Rhoda, because with technology now, the access to why is immediate, right? My girls will ask a question. I'm like, you know, I don't know. I'm old. I forgot. They go, Alexa, what is, you know, 2 + 2? The why happens right away.
Right.
So it's no longer a matter of a power, right, struggle. It's more of exposing them to knowledge, understanding.
Yes.
And if they understand it, right, what happens to the emotional intensity that we're seeing, Rhoda?
Right. You'll see a decrease. Now, that's not to say it won't be there, but you will see a decrease in that because I understand the why behind it. You just telling me no more phone, no more this, only this amount of time. But why? And you're right. Some of us, depending on the age group, we see that as disrespectful for a child to say, well, why, mommy? Well, this is why. They deserve that. They're little humans. We want to know why, as adults, certain things are happening. Same thing with our kids.
Yeah.
And we have to be consistent. Once we set those limits, we have to be consistent. And I'm guilty.
That's the hard part.
That is hard. I have a soon-to-be 12-year-old. It is so hard when he gives me those googly eyes, like, just 15 more minutes. But I have to be consistent.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So for parents out there who are nodding their head, just like we all are, how do you know when you have a significant or an issue that might be kind of outside of the norm?
Yeah. And to add on to that question, Wendy, we're it sounds like, Rhoda, the new typical is different, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The new atypical is also different.
Mm-hmm. Oh, true.
So if the majority of our kiddos are now, you know, post-COVID, their technology, right, generation, mm-hmm. and access to information generation, and the whys are a new normal, then what's now the abnormal for the
right
there?
And that's a good point. And I don't even know if I have an answer for that, but that's a very good point, because in our society, just what we hear and see on the daily in what's happening on the news, mm-hmm. we are all becoming, I don't know, desensitized to what used to be, oh my God, when you hear that versus now, oh, okay. So what is the new normal? What is atypical now in this society? Mm-hmm. I think when kids start to become withdrawn, they are not themselves. And I know you know this, they don't want to do or engage in activities they used to really love. Spend time with friends. They become, more aggressive, harmful to themselves or others or animals and things like that. You know, we need to, some red flags need to go off. And if that behavior persists, you know, we're not just talking about for a week or two, we start seeing someone withdrawn or, you know, acting out or anger. But mm-hmm. if it persists for some time, you know, a lot of the information we read says 6 months or more. I think personally, that's a little bit too long for those mm-hmm. things to go on, because we can develop new habits that's going to be really hard to break. But, you know, if in a couple, 2 to 3 months, that you don't see a shift and them getting back to a sense of normalcy as what you know for your child, we need to start asking for help and talking to someone.
Mm. So, you know, going back to what's the new normal and abnormal, what would you say might be some different expectations that teachers and parents might be having right now that need to be talked about, as far as involvement, communication, the role of a teacher versus a parent in the school-age child?
That's a really good question. I think there lies some of the problems within our school system, because we haven't clearly defined the role of the school versus the role of the parent. We're kind of finding our way as things change. And even within our school system, what we do every day with the team that I work, we're trying to teach teachers their new role given the new norms in our society. So a lot of our older parents feel like that is the school's job, to teach my kids social skills, reading, writing, math, and everything else. And don't call me, because that's your job. What do you want me to do about it? Our new parents, there are no boundaries. Our younger parents, I should say, oftentimes, not all. So please, I don't want to
generalize. Yeah.
Yes. There are very few boundaries. So when the kids come to school, they feel like they can say and do and whatever with or to the teacher, and the teacher's offended. Mm-hmm. So we have to, as a society, I think this is what's missing, get our parents and our educational system on the same page about what we can do and how we can support each other. Because it's not just a home thing and a school thing. I go back to that old saying, and you probably know what I'm going to say. It takes a village, and it still takes a village. It's not just the parent and the school. We have to work together, especially when our kids are experiencing mental health challenges.
Yeah.
Because our kids, oftentimes what we found, I'm getting skills outside of the home, and I can only generalize it to that setting. And when I come to school, I forget what I've learned in therapy or in sessions, because I don't realize what I learned there, I can apply here. Mm-hmm. And same thing in our schools. we're teaching some skills in isolation, but when I go back to the classroom, I don't use those skills because I didn't realize I can generalize it from this one-on-one to the classroom setting. And we feel like the interventions aren't working, but interventions work.
Yeah.
It just has to be that communication between home, school, and within that community of people supporting that child.
Yeah, it sounds like a first step would be the parent as the informant, right? Mm-hmm. I happen to have the privilege of just being educated on mental health as a provider myself. But
right.
When my kiddos have a rough start to the day, just one email to the teacher, hey, she had a very emotional start, just FYI, let me know how it goes. Mm-hmm. And then she emails me at the end of the day, we worked it out. Thanks for the heads up.
I had to do one of those today with my kid.
Yeah. But I think it's important what you just said, given your line of work,
right?
You know to do that. You know how important that is. Oftentimes our kiddos who are experiencing those challenges or coming into school that way, they don't have that level of support. And parents don't realize, hey, if I do this, my kid could have a better day. Because the teacher now knows, and now they know how to respond to my child. So I think it, again, goes back to that communication piece. And we talk to our teachers about relationships with students, but we also talk about teachers, you have an obligation to build and work on relationships with parents. They are your biggest ally. Yeah. They are the ones that can support you and help you. We need to focus on the student-teacher relationship is just as important as the teacher-parent relationship. So parents who don't have our background will feel comfortable enough to say, hey, Johnny woke up this morning on the wrong side of the bed and they are struggling. I just want to give you a heads up.
Yeah.
If you don't have a relationship with the teacher, you're not going to be comfortable doing that. Or if you don't have that background, you won't know to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think empowering our parents and educating them as well as our teachers about the importance of those relationships is also another key factor.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes our parents have to forge that with the teacher. And oftentimes we may not know how to do it because when it's done, it's in response to something. Mm-hmm. And that relationship harm has already been done to the relationship before it even got started. So making sure from the get-go, when we meet our teachers, our parents go into open house. They pick up schedules for high school, middle school. Take the time, talk to teachers, let them know, hey, you can call me. I'm here if you need anything. Reach out, even if you have a straight A student, if you have a gifted student, not just for challenging kiddos. I do it with my son. I schedule a conference every quarter. Hey, I want to touch base. What's going on? How's he doing? Oh, he's great. Why are you meeting with us? So I want you to know I'm here. Mm. And I want you to know you can share things with me. So having that comfort level between the two parties, we have to forge that as an education system in some way, shape, or form so that parents are comfortable doing that.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times parents are intimidated or, you know, working on in the side of business that I work on in the hospitals, we see a lot of kids that have problems at school and they're compounded. And then, you know, yeah. The parents are involved and we see bullying, we see anxiety, and it's gotten to this level where we're so far, I guess, in an acute state that we have to do a little bit more in-depth psychiatric care. Mm-hmm. You know, so for families that are dealing with some of those higher level needs. You know, I know we talked a little bit about risk factors and what to look for. What can a family do? Maybe this is a good question for you, Marielle, when we're looking at an inpatient residential stay.
Mm-hmm. So at that point, right, if we're focusing on the academics, as we've been saying, communication. And one of the things that I see that can impact a child's recovery is confusing academics and education as the ongoing priority. And it can have a lot of pressure. We have individuals and families who go through it, you know, from the beginning, and you know, they're lucky enough to have either awareness or a provider who communicates and teaches them, right, what to expect and what to do next. Some don't, so they're in and out. Or a child's mental health needs are acute. They can't focus at home. Their grades are declining, and they might encounter a barrier with the school system understanding or accommodating and being flexible. So as a provider, as a clinician myself, we're communicating with the school. We will offer letters and advocacy on their behalf. And this is another caveat or a question for Rhoda too, is what does a parent do at that point? So either a teacher or a family identifies that there is a disruption that is beyond academic, right? Something else is going on. It's not getting better. What can I do about it? What are my rights? What are my avenues? A teacher is saying, okay, well, we'll just work through it. And it's not enough.
Right. That's a very good question. In Florida, we have what is known as a multi-tiered system of support. And I think if parents were more aware of that, which is known as MTSS, that is where it starts. So hopefully we won't get to the point where we have to come to UVC, La Amistad, because we've addressed it early on. With the multi-tiered system of support, parents, teachers recognize that a student or their child is having difficulty, whether academically or behaviorally, and that they need some additional supports or services more than what everyone else is receiving. And with that, the school is obligated to provide services and supports, tiered interventions for kids before we even start looking at exceptional student education. Oftentimes we jump right to that when it's not even necessary. So what are we doing to support the student early on when we begin to notice those risk factors, those signs, those symptoms, be it academically, a decline in grades, mental health, aggressive behavior, you know, hearing voice, whatever it is, what are we doing about it? And the team coming together and problem solving. That's the part we miss. We have to begin that problem-solving process and not assume things and get interventions and supports in place. And parents aren't aware of that. Mm-hmm. We have an obligation to do that, whether it's through social skills, whether it's through academic interventions. That's our job. And interventions work. The whole goal is not to move your child through to ESE or exceptional student education, where they get a label of specific learning disabled, emotionally disabled. But how do we get them back to the point where they are receiving and able to function in the same environment, same setting as our other students, what we call our tier one?
Yeah.
So I think that's where it starts, parents having a knowledge of what can be provided. I know here in Seminole County, we have district mental health counselors. They don't provide tiered interventions, but it is a service or support that parents can get in the school system when we talk about significant mental health challenges. Mm-hmm. And there are other resources, but I think the first step is parents having awareness that that is there. And then if for some reason we have to move to exceptional student education, where a student starts to receive services that requires a label, so to speak, what are my rights there? A lot of parents don't understand that process. A lot of parents don't understand that the individual education plan, or also known as the IEP, that is a legal document. That is a legal document that schools must follow. And as parents, we have to hold schools accountable for what we're saying is going to happen in this individual education plan. Mm-hmm. And parents understanding, if it's not working, if our kids aren't progressing, you can always go back and make changes to it. You don't have to wait a year to do that. So it's just a knowledge of what's out there and what's available to parents, I think, is what we're missing, and that accountability piece. Parents have to now... No longer are the days where we trust that everybody's going to do what they're supposed to do in the best interest of my child. You have to hold people accountable. And whatever you expect or stated in that IEP, you inspect it. And if you don't know what you're looking for, you ask for help to be able to do that.
Yeah.
I think what you said earlier about it taking a village and not being intimidating to families, I love that you just said that, that we're here to wrap our arms around you and support you. And it's not punitive. No. And it's individualized.
Yes.
I think that message may not be heard by everybody, but should. And also advocacy, advocating for your child.
Yes.
You know, as a parent, you always have a gut feeling of, I know this is what my child needs. And being able to use your voice in the school setting, in a hospital setting. I mean, yes, much anywhere nowadays.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So we have viewers watching us today, and they are seeing some of these signs and symptoms in their kids. What would you recommend to build hope and resilience in their kids moving forward?
I think if I'll start it off, if you're seeing signs and symptoms of things that we've talked about today, the first thing you do is don't be afraid to ask for help. There are so many resources and supports within the school system itself that can be provided to you and your child. You just have to ask for help and not be intimidated by the process. We are there to help and support you and your child through the process, because if they're being successful, then we are successful. It's a win-win situation. It takes a team to do it. And I know sometimes when parents walk into meetings, whether it's a multi-tier system of support meeting or an IEP meeting, you have 10 people around the table, all literally speaking another language because we're using all these acronyms. And it can be intimidating, even for the most educated individual who has no background in education. Don't be afraid to speak up. Don't be afraid to ask for help. Your first step is your child's school counselor. And after you talk with the school counselor and ask for a meeting, an MTSS meeting, which is different from a parent-teacher conference. That's not what you're asking for. You're asking for an MTSS, a multi-tiered system of support meeting, where you meet as a team and determine, are additional supports needed? If so, what are those supports? Who will be providing those? And how will that be communicated to me as a parent about what's taking place so that I can do my part and reinforce at home? Because you have to be speaking the same language. Whatever your child is being taught to address the issue, you have to speak that same language at home, so it becomes just how things are and they can understand it.
Mm-hmm. Those are great tips. And for families who are seeing some of those serious red flags, there's other resources out there, LAMSDOD. For one, provides residential levels of care for kids that may need additional services. There's 988 that anybody could call at any time. It's a helpline. There's always someone there. There's many avenues, but what you just said is everything. Share what you're hearing. Ask for help. You don't have to stand in this alone. There's other families. There's support groups. We have NAMI across the country that has supportive groups for families, for moms, for dads, for siblings, for individuals, all kinds of resources out there that we can tap into. Mm-hmm. Marielle, any closing thoughts on your end?
Yeah, you know, we've been talking about the population that expresses their pain and their struggle. I think it's also equally important to ask the quiet kids, the kids who have straight A's, who say they're fine, who are the presidents and the, you know, the varsities and the IBs and busy and they have a life and they're just thriving. That doesn't mean anything, right? That
agreed.
Could mean that they're just functioning well and hiding it. So, you know, the message for everyone in general is don't let our kids get away with saying fine. School is not just about grades and tests. It's about friends. And did you eat? Were you tired? Did you have water? Did you feel connected today? What did you learn? You know, what confused you? And you know, kind of just treating school and that world as a stranger, which triggers parents to have this perspective of curiosity. I want to know everything. Tell me more, tell me more, tell me more. Because when they don't say anything, that can also be a red flag.
Yes. So very good point. Very good point.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I'd like to say, if I might, you made me think about something. A youth group somewhere in Central Florida, at a church. If you are a member of a church, or if your child is in Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, any type of organization like that, parents, if your child isn't a talker, they don't like to open up, they don't like to share, there is a phenomenal activity that a teacher started, and you guys probably heard it, I wish my teacher knew.
Mm-hmm.
At this church, they ask all of the youth members to share, I wish my parents knew.
Mm-hmm.
And they submitted it anonymously. And the things that these kids shared, mm-hmm. and these are kids like you just talked about, your varsity football players, your cheerleaders, your cheerleading captain, these kind of kids, not the kids we typically think about. It was amazing. It was scary. It was sad. And I know a lot of the parents, for a lot of the parents in that audience, it was an eye opener. So if your kids aren't talking and they aren't sharing, but they do participate in a youth group or sports team, get with the coach, get with the youth leader, get with whoever's over that and say, can you do this activity with the whole group? I'm just wondering what they would say. I wish my parents knew. And we'd be surprised some of the stuff that they share.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Love that.
And if you have younger kids, one of the things I do with my little boy who's 7, before he goes to bed at night, we read books and do all and brush teeth and all that. But right before he goes to bed, it's our talk time. Mm-hmm. And he can talk about anything. It could be silly. It could be serious. It's up to him. He knows like that's his set time and it's confidential. It's just between me and him.
Yep.
And sometimes he'll bring out big things where I'm like, oh my gosh, how do you even mm-hmm. know about that?
Yeah.
But he takes advantage of it. And it's, you know, it's another great tool to use if you have younger kids.
Yeah. And if you're having those conversations, be mindful of your response. You made me think about Wendy.
Yes.
About Wendy.
Yes.
Because
I love that you said that.
If you like, oh,
no. Yeah.
They
no.
may shut down. Try to be as neutral yes. as you can as you're listening so that they will continue. And I had to learn that the hard way.
Same.
Because I responded that way about something and he was like, I don't want to talk to you about that anymore.
Yep.
But it's important stuff. So be mindful of what you say in response to and your body language in response to whatever it is they're sharing.
Yes. Body language is everything.
Yeah. Yes.
It's learned the most from seeing what we do and how we
yes.
model.
Yeah. Yep. Modeling. Yep.
Well, it's been a joy talking to you both today. Thank you for your mm-hmm. expertise and appreciate your time. Viewers, thanks for tuning in and we will see you next time on My Matters. Have a great day, everyone.
You too. Thank you for having us. Mm-hmm.